Don't you know? We're talking about a revolution. Sounds like a whisper. Don't you know? We're talking about a revolution. Sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know? Talking about a revolution sounds whisper. Who are people gonna rise up and get their share? Who are people gonna rise up and take what's theirs? Don't you know you better run, 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 run. Oh, I said you better run, 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 run.
This is Tony Glover, and welcome to Out FM on WBA 99.5 FM in New York. Today we're going to discuss the Black Panther Political Party and the Gay Liberation Movement and how they came together in the 1960s. A bit of a historical lesson, and our featured guests will be David Hilliard and Erica Huggins. A little bit more on them later. First, I'd like to read from a news article by Raleigh Grau, and it talks a little bit about how the two movements came together. In the months following the Stonewall riots of June 1969, the fledgling gay liberation movement sought to form alliances with other progressive movements. But new left groups were usually no less homophobic than the rest of the country. A breakthrough came, however, in the summer of 1970 when Black Panther Party leader Huey P. Newton announced support for gay and lesbian equality. His statement was the first pro-gay pronouncement to come from the Black civil rights movement. In a letter from Huey to the Revolutionary Brothers and Sisters about the Women's Liberation and Gay Liberation Movements, published August 21, 1970, in the party's newspaper, this letter was as much a reprimand to fellow Panthers for homophobia and sexism as it was a call for coalition. Newton writes, "As we all know, sometimes our first instinct is to want to hit a homosexual in the mouth and want a woman to be quiet. We want to hit a homosexual in the mouth because we're afraid we might be homosexual, and we want to hit the woman or shut her up because we're afraid that she might castrate us. The remedy," he said, "is to gain security in ourselves and therefore have respect and feelings for all oppressed people." Admitting that the party had failed to consider gay issues, Newton observed, "Homosexuals are not given freedom and liberty by anyone in the society. Maybe they might be the most oppressed people in the society." Newton also addressed what had become a particularly sore point for gay activists. Quote, "The terms faggot and punk should be deleted from our vocabulary, and especially we should not attach names normally designed for homosexuals to men who are enemies of the people." The relationship between gay activists and the Black Panther Party was just beginning. The Gay Liberation Front, a gay radical organization of the time, had already supported the Panther Party, and this caused a split amongst some gay activists. But even, actually, the Gay Liberation Front was vocal in its criticisms of movement homophobia. A few months before Newton's statement, at a rally to demand the release of the incarcerated Panther leader Bobby Seale, the Gay Liberation Front's Jim Farrut called on radical leftists to stop using the word faggot to describe their enemies and to confront their own bias against gays. Another speaker at the rally was the gay French writer Jean Genet, who had come to the United States to win support for the Panthers among American intellectuals. Like Farrut, he objected to the use of the word faggot. According to his biographer Edmund White, Genet's comments are what prompted Newton's statement on gay liberation. So that's a little bit of background information, and I wanted to now introduce our guests, Erica Huggins and David Hilliard. First, a little bit about them. Erica Huggins grew up in Washington, D.C. and was 15 when she attended the March on Washington in 1963. The event ignited a passion for social action, and she went on to become a member of the Black Panthers, a party built on the premise that by the 1960s, nonviolence as a strategy had had its day. According to Huggins, the thing that moved her most during the march was when singer Lena Horne stood up at the microphone and sang the word freedom. It rang out over our heads, she said, and landed on our ears in such a way that it sent a chill down my spine. I knew the event would have an impact on the African-American community that would last for generations. It was already having an enormous impact on my life. I knew that I wanted to serve my people. Indeed, Erica Huggins has served her people. Today, she is educator with parents, children, and teens. It's that kind of work she's done most of her life, including the time that she was in the Black Panther Party. During that time, she ran the Oakland Community School, which became a model for alternative schools. She's a mother of three, and part of what anchors her in her life is meditation. Part of what meditation does is provide the foundation for her to work on the uplift of humanity. And she says it's very important that you, our listeners, know that she comes from that place of inner focus. Welcome, Erica.
Thank you.
And David Hilliard, as chief of the staff of the Black Panther Party, David Hilliard was actively involved in every major activity of the best recognized, and I think one of the most respected African-American organizations in the 1960s and 70s. The Panthers occupy a very unique place in the civil rights movement. Their goal was to politically organize the inner city poor, the underclass, part of what they called the lumpen, quote-unquote, whose members now represent such a profound challenge to American society. David Hilliard and Erica Huggins actually both speak for these people, I think. Hilliard is author of the book The Side of Glory, a compelling personal narrative and an eyewitness account of the Black Panthers that reclaims a piece of history long obscured and now almost lost. Welcome, David Hilliard.
Thank you very much.
And I'm going to stop talking now because that was a rather long introduction to this piece, but I just wanted to give people a little bit of history of how it came that the Black Panther Party addressed issues of sexual politics and the gay liberation movement. And I wanted to, I guess, start with you, David, in terms of how Huey P. Newton came to address the issue of gay liberation. Besides some of the things I mentioned, what was your recollection of that time period and the impetus for the Panther Party to address the issue, to address a issue that few in the civil rights movement, or actually in speaking to Erica, she really made clear to me that the Panther Party was more about a human rights movement. So what is your recollection of those times and how the issue of gay liberation came to be addressed?
Well, there were more than a few of our members who used the derogatory expletive faggot to describe the powers that be, mm-hmm. Nixon, Hoover, J. Edgar Hoover, Ronald Reagan, and French playwright, activist Jean Genet came to America. And while he was in New York, in particular, he visited many of the demonstrations there and had this very close relationship with our people there in our New York chapter. And as he went around the city at these rallies in Morris Park and other places in New York, he's constantly being offended with the usage of the word faggot.
Mm-hmm.
So he came back to California and visited Huey Newton and made clear his outrage at the fact that we were using a term that he considered as derogatory, as, you know, whites calling blacks niggers,
mm-hmm.
and admonished, asked Huey if he would write some declaration putting a cessation of that kind of derogatory language against gays who were not our enemies, and not to refer to gays in the same context as we would in terms of scorning Nixon or Hoover or establishment oppressors, that gays were not our oppressors, that in fact they were our revolutionary oppressed community comrades. So Huey issued that statement as a response to Jean Genet and his outrage at, you know, our people in our movement using that word against the gay community in general. Mm-hmm. And as a result, this article came out in the 70s that you just made reference to.
And Erica, what was it about Huey Newton that allowed to him to both listen and hear what Jean Genet came from. And speaking to you a little bit prior to our interview today, I got the sense that Huey was uniquely able to actually listen and hear to what a person would say, especially around the issues of oppression.
That's true. He also was that way about children and mm-hmm. teenagers. Huey was a visionary. And so he listened with an openness that is true to people who have a higher vision about how people can live together. Mm. There aren't any human beings that don't have red blood or breathe air, and we all do breathe together. So his way of interacting with us when we received a critique or when there needed to be a revision of our understanding was to let us know, this doesn't work any longer. Why don't we think about it this way? Mm-hmm. And I remember I was in prison from 1969 to 71, and I remember feeling the impact of this letter when I read it on me and therefore the women I was incarcerated with, many of whom were women with women lovers who on the streets were prostitutes. And so this had a really poignant impact on the women from that class that you named, the lumpen proletariat, meaning those who are below the working class, that are working, as the society would say, illegally or outside of employment, as the government would look at it. So everywhere there was suffering, Huey looked to see how it could be uplifted. And I love that quality in him, and I will always remember it. And I was always listening with an open ear for the next way we would break out of boxes. There's so many layered boxes we live in, and I hope at some point in this chat we'll look at the box of being gay or lesbian and racist at the same time. That's a reverse of what Jean Genet and Huey had continual chats about.
Part of what was mentioned in the article I read is the Gay Liberation Front and how they were probably one, if not the only, organization to openly support the Black Panther Party. And in dealing with other gay activists or other gay groups of the time, that was a sticking point, partly because of the racism that existed within the gay movement at the time. In terms of, actually, why don't I stick on that point with, in terms of the Gay Liberation Front and the Black Panther Party, Black Panther Party initiated a Revolutionary People's Convention, which was attended by both organizations. How did it come that the Panther Party actually developed a platform around sexual politics? I'm sure part of the initiative came from Huey Newton's statement, but there must have been other workings within the organization that including, I assume, the membership of gay and lesbian members, out or not. Actually, it really isn't that important to me. But in terms of also the women within the organization, did the impetus come from those members mostly, or how did that come about?
Well, in terms of the Revolutionary People's Constitutional Convention, mm-hmm. it was certainly an exercise in democracy. We were about the business of hearing the demands and making certain that there was this democratic approach to writing this constitutional amendment, and mm-hmm. women were central, as were gays, in this new world that we were trying to help forge. So the end result of what you're talking about in terms of the constitutional amendments were all put together out of these meetings that we had where people were represented, you know, regardless of their gender, class, racial politics. So people came into these groupings with their ideas and their platforms. And, of course, all of that was a part of trying to make up this new constitutional mandate that had truly a democratic representation. So the gays and women were a big part of that. That's sort of how that came about.
And Erica, where did the impetus come from in terms of, like, the membership? In other words, there were women members, there were male members, there were people who were in the party who were straight identified, people in the party who were gay identified. In terms of the impetus to address sexual politics, did it come from any one particular segment, for lack of a better word, or was it more a group consciousness that this had to be addressed? These two issues.
I think it became a group consciousness as time went on.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't speak about the People's Constitutional Convention because I was in jail at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I can't speak about any direct experience.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know that from the moment that I returned home to Oakland and to my party work, that I recognized how strong, and before I was imprisoned as well in Los Angeles, how strong the women in the party were.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean strong in the sense of their own desire to be in the leadership of the party, but strong in themselves. They were women who naturally stepped out of a box in order to join a revolutionary organization, which, of course, at that time in history, had been run by and even established and maintained by men. So that was one thing that I was always aware of.
Mm-hmm.
And our organization, many of us lived communally,
mm-hmm.
and none of us thought that we would live to be older than 30.
Hmm.
We all thought we'd be killed at one point.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if David agrees with this, but I certainly lived with this awareness. Each morning I was happy that I was still alive.
Hmm.
And I don't say that lightly.
Mm-hmm.
I do know that because we lived on the edge, let's say, less societal constructs were useful to us. Less of what people would think about us was useful. So, for instance, women would love other women. I don't remember seeing this so prominent with men, but I'm not saying it did not exist. I'm just saying we were all very loving, supportive and caring of one another, and we were the same way with our children. We all took care of the children together.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have a lot of judgments about one another within the party.
Mm-hmm.
However, we weren't, as individual members, the kinds of people who would then speak about it publicly as we went to do our political work. It
right.
didn't seem important at the time. In the same way, feminism, when it was beginning to be very strong in public awareness, was an enigma to us because we were already feminist by the very virtue of our lives. So the other side of the feminist coin was that it didn't have the same kind of meaning for black women and women of color as it did for white women.
And David, from your perspective, think that how open could a gay person be in the Black Panther Party, and how about in terms of men loving men within the party? And I guess when I say a love, I don't just mean a sexual thing. I mean in terms of being openly affectionate, respectful of people within the party who were gay identified.
Well, I don't personally have any experience of ever seeing an open display of, you know, gay men, you know, being affectionate within our movement. But certainly we were on the cutting edge of trying to make certain that people were not oppressed because of their sexual orientation or preferences. So we'd already laid the guidelines and were open for having an open society and tried to advance this new world with men and women. That's what our movement was about.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to think if that demonstration of affection between male members in our organization, if it had happened, we would have dealt with it as we did in our alliances with the gay movement.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just something that we put out as a thesis, but it was our practice within our movement to try to be open and democratic. So I'd like to think that we would have approached it and dealt with it in a way where the rights of gays would have been respected and openly demonstrated within our movement.
And actually, the interview is far too brief. One of the issues I wanted to address before we close was kind of piggybacking on what you just said in terms of the inner workings of the Panther Party. One of the things I've come to learn, especially as we get more distant from the time in which certain activism and civil rights and human rights movements take place, is there becomes a cult of personality associated with an organization and or its leaders. And I was wondering if you might both address what are some of the most common misunderstandings around the Black Panther Party in terms of its sexual politics?
Well, we were certainly not homophobic. That was our Black Panther Party stood in the vanguard more than any other organization out of that era in supporting sexual politics, issues around gender. We were not just for gays, but also women liberation. We were at the forefront of alliances with the women and feminist movement. So, you know, our organization has been misunderstood. Certainly, in that area, the area around gender politics, and you know, it serves well. It bodes well for people who are studying our movement to take a deeper look at that, and to have these kind of interviews that you're conducting now to sort of give people a clear introspection into our movement and to get closer to the essence of what we represented. And at base, it was about democracy for all human beings.
And part of what develops in looking back on history and looking at an organization like the Black Panther Party is that we feel like what they did was too big for us to begin to make a similar type of movement today around revolutionary politics, issues of sexual identity, sexual politics, the issue of racism. And I was wondering, Erica, if you could perhaps address how are we able to get beyond this idea that we can't have an organization like the Black Panther Party again? Where does the impetus come from? Or where did the impetus come from to develop and or participate in the Black Panther Party? How might that be applied for today?
Well, first of all, I wanted to address the question that you asked a few minutes ago that David answered so beautifully. And I just want to say one more thing, and that is that it is true that as we come forward in history so many years later, decades later, that the way that books and history and even school teachers, I have a teenage son who is studying the human rights movement right now in his history class, and the way the Black Panther Party often is remembered is as a group of straight African-American men. And that just isn't true of what we really were in fact. That isn't to say that there weren't many, many straight African-American men, but there were also women. There were also people who had all kinds of sexual orientation and ages and lifestyles. And our children were a part of that democracy that David spoke about, which is why Huey made certain that the school that I ran for 10 years was created for the sake of the children so that they would have a classroom, a philosophy that the world is their classroom and that they would be lifelong learners, which many of them are in education now for that very reason. And then the question that you just asked about how do we move forward from this moment on and do things for the upliftment of humanity, the simple answer is, we do something. When babies learn how to walk, they don't just get up and take steps forward and keep going. They crawl and then they step out and they fall and they take some steps and then they wobble and then they walk eventually. And that was what Huey Newton and Bobby Seale did when they sat down at the Merritt College Student Union building and began to draft the 10-point program and platform for the Black Panther Party. They said, we have to do something. Let's do something. And so all of the somethings that they intended to do became the Black Panther Party and all of the things that happened from it. And certainly there were all kinds of mistakes that occurred as we moved along throughout the years. But it was a heartfelt movement. It wasn't just that the keen intellect of Huey Newton and Bobby Seale ran the show. The listening that we did to the people who were in that place of suffering at that time prompted us to keep revising and changing our not only our doing, but our being. Hmm. So people listening to this show can think about what they can personally offer to the world and offer that. And I think that what I learned in the party, if there isn't anything else, is that it's not okay for me to be entirely self-referential. Hmm. That it is important for me to think of all human beings and include myself in that as I live my life, moment to moment, day to day.
And I'm going to end on that point and thank Erica Hilliard.
Erica Hilliard.
Erica Hilliard and David Huggins. See, I got y'all married already. Thanking David Hilliard and Erica Huggins for participating in an illuminating and I hope uplifting discussion. Thank you both for joining us today. And I just wanted to let people know that for more information on the Black Panther organization and their continuing legacy, there are various foundations that are continuing the legacy of what the Black Panther Party stood for. You can go to www.blackpanther.org. Erica Huggins and David Hilliard, thank you once again.
Thank you so much. Standing in the welfare lines, crying to those observers, armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution. Talking about a revolution, oh, oh no. Talking about a revolution, oh, oh no. Talking about a revolution.